It's time for Twig This Week in Google. What a great show. Bruce Schneier will join us, the many-time lauded security guru expert, to talk about the NSA privacy and what we can do about it. Kevin Marks, Matt Cutts from Google, Jeff Jarvis too. A great Twig is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com.
This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 211, recorded August 14th, 2013. We just installed the internet. This Week in Google is brought to you by LegalZoom.com. Visit LegalZoom.com for affordable legal solutions you can trust. LegalZoom can provide self-help services at your specific direction or connect you with an attorney. They're not a law firm. They're better. Visit LegalZoom.com and use the promo code TWIG to receive $10 off at checkout. It's time for This Week in Google, the show that covers Google, the cloud, the Googleverse, and anything, frankly, Jeff and Gina and I want to talk about. And we just consider yourself warned. I'm Leo Laporte. Joining us, Jeff Jarvis, as always. Professor of Journalism at the City University of New York, author of What Would Google Do in His Latest Public Parts. Look, he's zooming in.
I'm not.
Maybe we are. What are you building in there? It looks like you've got a scaffolding holding up the wall over your left shoulder.
That's my IKEA thing for holding whiteboards.
Oh, okay.
Which I now have on my windows trying to block the light so I don't look so incredibly white.
Nice to have you.
I looked very pink. Now I look very white. I can't win.
Whitest man in journalism. Thanks for joining us. Pinkest, really. Gina has the day off today, but we've got some great replacements. Matt Cutts from Google is here via audio. We'll get his video in a sec. Oh, there he is. Hey, Matt.
Hello.
I like it because Matt's always sitting in a comfy chair when he joins.
He's always leaning back.
He's always relaxed. Also with us, Kevin Marks of Salesforce.com, formerly of Google, Apple.
Hi there.
And the BBC. Hey, Kevin. So, Jeff, you have booked somebody I've been trying to get on Twit for 7 or 8 years now, one of the premier guys in security. Frankly, if Bruce Schneier says it, I believe it. He, among other claims to fame, you helped Neil Stephenson with the crypto in Cryptonomicon, right? His card deck crypto.
Yeah, I built a playing card cipher that he used in the plot. And the neat thing was I got to write an afterword in the book.
Which I loved.
And the extra neat thing is I got to accompany him on some book signings and learn that cypherpunk writers get way better groupies than photographers ever do.
Bruce, it is such an honor to talk to you. Really, you are a legend in the business. And especially now more than ever.
Now more than ever.
We need Bruce Schneier. Schneier.com. If you want to read his blog, Schneier on Security, there is really nobody who is more trenchant or accurate, entertaining even on the subject. So, Jeff, since you were the guy who got us this great booking, I'll let you take the lead on this one.
So much. We have so little time. We have Bruce to the top of the hour. But start here, Bruce. You wrote a great piece for The Atlantic and about a topic that I was trying to tackle too, but you frankly did it far better than I did. Is the fear that the NSA is commandeering the net. I was thinking about it in terms of what they're doing maybe to individual companies where there are people with security clearance and their bosses don't have it. They don't know what they're doing inside the company. And I couldn't figure out how to express that. And you just came up to the very clear view that they're just plain commandeering the internet. And then you're also arguing that what technology companies, it's time for them to fight back. Why don't you talk about that for a second?
You know, it's really part of this very broad trend of surveillance being everywhere. I mean, if you think about it, surveillance is the business model of the internet. I mean, that's how Google makes its money. It surveils us and serves us personalized ads. That's how Facebook makes its money. That's how everyone's making their money, by mining us for our data and then buying, selling, and using it. And it turns out that the government wants access to it too. Right, and stuff they can't get for legal reasons or technical reasons, they're learning to get from these corporations. Either they're asking nicely, right? We've seen example after example of companies willingly subverting their security or willingly handing the NSA copies of everything. They'll do it through national security letters. They'll force companies to do it. CLIA is something that's going through Congress, trying to, where the FBI has gotten phone companies to make their networks eavesdropping ready. So, I mean, I think of this as a public-private surveillance partnership. So, yes, the NSA is commandeering the internet for its own purposes, but also, you know, companies are surveilling us for their own purposes and using law to protect them. So it kind of goes both ways, unfortunately.
Bruce, I've always been much more worried, though, about a government surveilling us than about private corporations trying to sell us. Doesn't that seem a little bit more nefarious?
Well, I mean, sell us is just the beginning of it. It's being used to deny people loans, to deny people banking privileges.
Redlining, digital redlining.
But redlining, not just even denying people access to banking. There's an article recently about people judged by computer algorithms and being denied bank accounts. So now they're forced to use these more expensive unbanks and check cashing services. You know, these corporations are not just selling us consumer products. They're very much controlling our lives. If you can't get a cell phone, you can't live the same life. You can't get a credit card. So, you know, looking at corporate power, it's different than government power. But corporate power is pretty darn extreme. And,
yeah, Bruce,
you know...
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I mean, I just really see both types of power working together. And sort of there's this weird libertarian fantasy that if the government does something, it's bad. And then if a corporation does it, it magically becomes good. I usually tend to look at the thing and not... You know, who writes the paycheck of the people in power that are doing it?
Yeah, I'm more afraid of guns, though, than I am of redlining. But I'll acknowledge that both are problems. How do you fight it?
In Egypt right now, the rock, paper, scissors in Egypt is the army always wins over the internet.
Right.
Let me continue on with Leo's question, Bruce. That when I talked to Vince Cerf about this at Guardian Activate in London, someone asked him whether the solution to this is technological or institutional, that is to say laws and policy and principles. How far does the technological solution take us here, and what are its limitations, and how do we solve it institutionally?
So I don't think that technology takes us very far at all. And so here's a great example. I'm asked an email all the time. You know, I want to use a secure email service. Who should I use? And the truth is, I don't know, right? I don't know what companies have been subverted by the government, what claims are true, what claims are lying. Last week, we saw two small secure email services, LavaBit and
Silent Circle.
Silent Circle.
Phil
Zimmerman's
company.
They shut themselves down, one after they received national security letters, one before, right? So these independents are going away. What's left of the big corporations that really have no choice but to cooperate. So, you know, the technology only takes you so far, but you can't trust the technology because you can't trust anybody's claims. I mean, these are very much political problems, and the solutions are going to be political. Now, once we have the correct politics in place, there's a lot technology can do because there are a lot of tech problems, but they are subservient to the political problems. I mean, right now...
Which goes to your point... of trying to get the tech companies to fight now, that if they want to prove whose side they're on, are they on our side, or are they collaborators with the government, or are they victims of its overreach?
But isn't it a meaningless question? I think Bruce is probably right. They are collaborators, but even if they weren't, they don't have NSL. And I know Matt Cutts works at Google, so he's gonna chime in there. But even if they weren't, I think it's moot, because even if they weren't, the law requires them to participate. And because they're public companies, they can't do as LavaBit and Silent Circle did, shut down. They have to keep operating.
Right. They have to cooperate.
They have to cooperate in China.
Right. They don't have to cooperate willingly. They don't have to do more than the law allows. And they don't have to go silently. So both Yahoo and Google have been great at fighting back. And they mostly lose. Right? Sometimes we win. You know, Brewster Kahle, the Internet Archive, fought a national security letter and won. And his story was in the New Yorker, I think, earlier this year. And our sort of only way to beat this back is to fight back. And even if you lose, you're going to lose on the narrow the narrowness of the letter. You're not going to cooperate more. There's a lot of articles now of companies that are cooperating because they're afraid if they get the letter, it'll be more annoying and more expensive. And it turns out not to be true. You fight. You keep the moral high ground. When this is all exposed, like, you know, what happened to Yahoo, what's happened to Google, we're all thinking, well, these companies are fighting for us. So even if they lose, I'm going to trust them more than I will a company that isn't fighting.
I also concerned that we don't know what's going on because of the silence requirements of many NSL. It may be much more than we even know, and they can't.
And it probably is. A lot of these silence requirements are being fought, and sometimes successfully. National letter doesn't go away, but the gag order does.
I look at Lavabit's founder, who apparently got something, but is so constrained about what he can talk about. He has to sit there with a lawyer next to him saying, no, whispering back and forth, what can you say, what can't you say? He risks prison by saying anything.
That's right.
But the companies can change. And they can stand up and say what ought to be. If they get away from the specifics of the cases against them, the companies need to stand up on the basis of principle and say, this is what we'll fight. This is what we'll stand up for you. You can be assured that we will do this or that. Because if they don't even say that, right now they're being silent. The companies are not coming out and saying much of anything, and that doesn't lead to trust. Plus, we, the users, have to give them cover. We have to demand that they fight so they can say to the government, hey, man, we're caught in the middle here.
Bruce's most recent book was about trust. It couldn't have been more timely. It came out last year, but you couldn't be more timely. I don't know if we can trust anybody at this point. And, you know, when you see, for instance, the FISA court itself 2 years ago trying to put out a report saying that the government is overreaching and then that being quashed by the Department of Justice, it is all being suppressed at this point as much as the government can.
There is. And it really amazes me that the NSA had no contingency plans for our secret programs get on the front page of the newspaper. You'd think with the major budget and security mindset that it'd have some plan B. I mean, here it is, a couple of months after General Alexander was at Black Hat, and the best he could do was explain how the FISA court works, talk about this Iranian cab driver who sent $5,000 back home. I mean, this is his defense. It just amazes me how flat-footed they were caught and how even now they're just making it up as they go along, hoping for the best. I mean, they have to believe that these thousands of documents are going to become public, all of them, sometime soon.
Right.
I mean, it's just not going to stay undercover much longer.
So could I take a little bit of the worry that we're painting with a little bit of a broad brush.
Matt cuts from Google. Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, and I don't know whether my video can come through or not. If my video does come through, I'm actually holding up a copy of Bruce's book. So
Liars and Outliers. Good. You're reading it. That's excellent.
This one's actually
the other one, Snare and Security, which is the classic. Yeah, I have too.
So
yeah.
I am a fan. I very much enjoy and agree with
that's
Bruce,
a must-have
about security theater. But I do think we don't want to paint with too broad of a brush, like talking about collaborators and talking about private-public partnership on some of this stuff, because, you know, from a lot of the coverage, you get the sense that a lot of this is more like a shotgun wedding where companies are compelled to. And I think you can look at the history of companies and get a sense for which ones are fighting for you versus which ones are like, hey, please give us a government request so we can hand over all the phone calling records of various Americans. So, for example, you know, Google was one of the first to really double down on encryption, both of Gmail and on search. Whenever we got a 2005 Department of Justice subpoena that wanted to turn over 2 months of users' queries for a lawsuit related to pornography, we fought that and we won, and 33 other companies didn't fight that. We've been very big on two-factor authentication. You know, there's an article in Wired that talks about a little device that lets you do two-factor authentication a little bit better. So, you know, I think to say that all these companies are just falling over themselves on this topic to help out the government is not a correct characterization. I think a lot of engineers in Silicon Valley are thinking about different ways that they can try to protect users' rights and protect security and privacy as best they can. You know, it was really wild to watch the events around Lavabit, and I think hopefully that will give a lot of people in the government pause and and make them think a little bit about just what they're doing. You know, they're really removing a lot of trust in the internet and in the cloud.
Yes,
yeah,
that's
the problem. You know, CDT just came out with a blog post, and they've been fighting the extension to CALEA. CALEA is the law that required phone companies to make their phone switches eavesdropping friendly. And the FBI's been trying to extend that law to the things like Gmail. And it's being fought. The law hasn't passed. But CDT's pointing out that these attacks against the smaller companies that are really forcing them to close or collaborate, the inability for the larger companies to close, so they have to basically hand over NSA data and then lie to their customers about it, is effectively getting this CLIA extension passed without the trouble of going through Congress.
Oish.
That effectively, right, all we have left are the large companies. Right, and it's sort of impossible. You can't imagine Mark Zuckerberg saying, "Well, we're just not going to comply. We're going to shut Facebook down. That's what we have to do." Right? He can't do that. It's a large public company. He'd be fired. They'd find a less moral CEO,
and they'd keep going.
Right, and,
yeah.
And it would continue.
Yeah.
So you know, we're now entering a world where you only have the big companies that collaborate, and you know they're forced to, and some fight, and some don't, and maybe we win around the edges, but largely we lose. And no small companies left, and that scares me.
Let me ask you another question, though, since you're the technologist here. In my field, in journalism, we yammer on a lot about professional ethics, and I have threatened to quit jobs over matters of ethics, and I know lots of people who have. And I know that Jonathan Zolotarev, right? No, Jonathan Zunger,
the architect
of Google Plus.
Zunger.
Uh-huh. Wrote a great post saying, listen, the thing you have to trust here is that if this stuff were going on and I knew about it, I'd leave the company.
Right.
How much discussion is there among technologists? Is there enough, do you think, about the ethics of a technologist? And how much can we trust those individuals? Is that where the wellspring of reaction is going to come up, is saying, no, I refuse to do that, or I have to quit, or whatever? Where does it get down to the individual or the individual within the company who has security clearance who's treated differently from everybody else?
Well, thank goodness for the Edward Snowdens and the Ladar Levisons of Lava Bit of the world, who have put their, in a way, put their life on the line.
Is there discussion of these ethical principles among developers, technologists, security people, and so on?
Yeah, certainly within Google, I think it's safe to say this is hotly debated, you know,
yeah.
And every week we have weekly discussions where we can ask, you know, Larry and Sergey questions, and it's entirely safe to say that even though we might not say that much externally because, you know, there's discipline about external communications, you can believe any hot topic outside of Google gets a firestorm of debate inside of Google. And so that's an entirely safe assumption. I assume that happens at a lot of companies as well.
So the president gave a press conference last Friday, and he did a couple of things which I applaud him for. One is acknowledged while our national law enforcement agencies are patriots and trying to protect our country. He also said, and I hope he believes this, that those who are fighting for privacy are also patriots and fighting for very fundamental constitutional tenets in this country. He also said, and I thought this was really telling, we have an unprecedented ability to gather this information. And you know, I think perhaps what happened is that unprecedented ability to gather the information snuck up on us, and we got this ability. And of course, somebody whose job is to protect the country is going to embrace anything. And the problem is the controls and the oversight have not been there, have not kept up. Is it enough to say to Congress, let's get this under control?
Well, I mean, you can say it; it has to get done. So Obama.
What else should we do?
I mean, I agree that's probably the mechanism, or at least one of the mechanisms. You know, the mechanisms, there are court cases going through. Obama said he'd do four things. You know, and of course the proof is in the pudding. Talked about reforming Section 215 of the Patriot Act. That's the section that has to deal with national security letters. So what does that mean? We don't know. To increase transparency of the FISA court. I mean, it's again a good idea, but the devil's in the details. The third is to make more information public, as can be made public. Again, good idea. And fourth is to appoint some kind of independent review board, which is either a good idea or a way to make the problem go away,
right,
and you know, put in a document. I mean, so these are four generalizations. you know, the details matter. I mean, yes, Congress could do a lot, right? We saw a few weeks ago the House tried to unfund one particular NSA surveillance program, the one that collects phone metadata of every American. That failed, but failed very narrowly. There are things the courts could do. EFF, ACLU, EPIC are all filing lawsuits trying to challenge the constitutionality of this aspect, of that aspect. Those are ways. There's a lot of public pressure now. I mean, congressmen are feeling this. The president is feeling this. And views are changing. You know, even some of the congressmen and senators who are pretty much on the side of security at all costs and don't really care about this are starting to change. So, I mean, there's a lot we can do. You have to just push on all fronts.
Yeah. Is it enough, or are those four things enough, or presuming they're done properly, or is there more that you would like?
You know, I think fundamentally our privacy laws are outdated. I mean, it's what you said. Technology continues to advance. The FBI, the NSA are continually grabbing this new technology because it's a gray area and not really covered under the law. They assume the most broad, expansive powers they can think of. And because the law was written in the 80s or sometimes then even the early
1980s.
You know, it's not that bad, but it's still pretty bad. It's still pre-internet.
Yeah.
So we really need the entire body of laws to catch up to technology. And if we're really good to write them technologically invariant, so we don't go through the same problem again in 20 years.
Yeah, that's where I'll disagree a little bit, Bruce. I think what we have to do is write the laws at a level of principle where, then I agree, they're invariant to the technology. The principle is that you don't suck up all the communication that occurs. Or here's a better example. Our first class letters, right, and packages only are secured so that they can't be opened without a warrant, right? The metadata can be taken, but the package cannot be opened. Anything else can be opened. Our email does not have that security. Our private chats, of course, don't have that security. Well, the principle at work here should be that private communication is private and is secure unless with a lawful warrant. That should be the principle that should exist against any technology, whether that's a letter or a phone call or a chat or an email. So what we have to do is actually, I think, raise this discussion high to the level of principle that we can then know what's being protected as citizens. And then the problem now is that, you know, in a way, you don't blame the spies, say, in the words of Alexander, gather it all. The more they can gather, they think that's their job. They're going to go as far as they can. And if the law is too specific to the technology and doesn't catch up, they're going to walk through that loophole. Whereas if the principle is set up that says you cannot listen to or in any way spy on private communication at an individual level until you have a warrant, that to me is pretty darn clear.
That's right. And it's resistant to whatever the next thing is. I mean, our problems have been – we had this with videotape rentals versus DVDs versus streaming video. We'll have it right, letters versus email, phone calls versus Skype calls. So, you mean, if you write the laws to the technology changes and your laws no longer apply or no longer work well. And if
we have to update the laws to the idea that technology is going to constantly change.
Right. You know, but this stuff is hard. You know, fundamentally, it's very hard – members of Congress, and I applaud the ones who managed to do it, to say to law enforcement, no, you can't have this. No, we're going to stand up for what's right, and we're not going to give you what you want. It's very easy to succumb to fear. I mean, you know, I feel their pain. I don't, you know, I have sympathy, even though I don't want them to do it.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the judiciary also is going to be a big part of this. Interpreting the laws to support the Fourth Amendment is going to be a big part of it. Bruce, we have a promise to let you go at this time, and I thank you so much for being here. Bruce,
all right, let's have you back, but I can stay longer.
I would love to have you back. Liars and Outliers is the latest book, Enabling the Trust That Society Needs to Thrive. Schneier.com is the website. Really a hero of mine, Bruce, so thank you for being here. We really appreciate it.
Hey, thank you.
Take care. We'll bring Matt Cutts now into the screen. Matt's thumbnail.
He can come to full size.
Well, no, it's not that. Unfortunately, we're having some weird problem with Hangouts, and the best we can do is a thumbnail. We can't get him to join. I don't know. It's
20 pixels by 20 pixels.
It's technology. I don't understand it. Oh, no, wait a minute.
I can see myself.
Look, you're big. Was it just the wrong machine or something?
We fixed
Honey,
it.
We shrunk Matt.
We unshrunk the Matt. Bruce is gone, but we can continue this conversation. Or either of you or any of you have thoughts that you want to make, about what we just said, Kevin, you're not even from here, from around here, but you can.
Yeah, I'm going to be careful what I say.
You're actually from a surveillance state yourself. I mean, Britain.
Now that we're talking to a foreigner, everything we say can be snooped upon. That's
Oh God, I didn't even think of that. Britain is no laggard in using technologies to surveil its citizens.
GCHQ has been doing that for a very long time.
Yeah.
It goes back to Walsingham in the 1500s, opening letters and looking for plots against Elizabeth. So, yeah, there's a long tradition.
That was the perfect Kevin Marks comment. Just want to make that clear.
I try hard not to get depressed. I guess the best thing that we can encourage people to do, I think it's going to have to go through Congress. At least that's where we can exercise our influence, is to support people like the EFF, the Center for Democracy and Technology, CDT.org, EPIC.
We also have to give cover
Open Rights
to
Group in UK.
Yeah. We have to give cover to those Congress people. We have to give cover to the technology companies.
I wish I could vote for Ron Wyden. I would.
Yeah. You can send him a contribution. I've sent Ron Wyden money to say
that's a good idea
for representing our interests. You know,
yeah,
and don't be afraid to call up Dianne Feinstein as chairman of the committee if this is how you feel about the subject, and say, look, if you really feel that this surveillance is a good idea, then I respectfully disagree with you, and I'll support other candidates. You got to let Congress know how you feel about these issues, or they won't. They won't have anything to go on.
And really, it is geeks who unfortunately kind of tend to want to turn our backs on politics, because it's messy. It's not binary. It involves compromise, which we're not so good at. But we are the ones who best understand what the issues and risks are here. And so it is us geeks who have to step forward and be heard.
Well, and this is what I want to go back to what Matt was talking about a minute ago, because I think this is highly important. And Matt's right to say, let's not paint the broad brush that every technology company is evil. We hear that kind of stuff too often. But we also need, I wrote a piece for The Guardian before Bruce did for The Atlantic, trying to tackle the same way he did a better job. But I see three tiers of companies that are ensnared in this. And at the highest level, it's the broadband companies that are letting the NSA and the GCHQ apparently listen into the entire damned internet.
Yeah, they're the worst.
They're the worst, right? Then there's telcos who hate us anyway, and we hate them anyway. But then there's the companies with whom we have a personal relationship: Google, Facebook, Twitter, and so on.
And perhaps your ISP as well. Throw them in the mix.
Well,
if you don't have a good ISP, get one. There are good ones locally here. SonicNet historically has fought the best. For our rights,
choice about that, and when we're imprisoned by an oligopoly or monopoly, we don't. But what we do have is my argument here is that the Googles and Twitters and Facebooks at all are our best hope, because they're the ones who lose the most if we lose trust in them, whether that's individual consumers or whether that's companies canceling contracts with American cloud providers because they don't trust us anymore. They have the most to lose. They have the most aligned interest. They have an actual relationship with us. And they're also ensnared in this. This is why this collaborator versus victim is still important, I think, because sometimes you can do this stuff very willingly, or you can say, I'm only doing what I have to do. And the more that we can give cover to those technology companies to, as Bruce says, fight, but also to make clear these principles on our behalf, I think they're our best hope. Congress is going to be mixed. Courts are going to be slow. Diplomacy is going to take forever. The executive branch is full FOS on this. Telcos and bandwidth companies don't care about us and never will. So to me, and I know I get accused of being a Google love boy and apologist, we need these companies to stand up and speak, and we need to give them the cover and the demand to do so. End of sermon.
I'm not sure I agree that you're going to ever get these companies as an entity to do any of this, because they are, for the most part, publicly held. They have a fiduciary responsibility to stakeholders to maximize profits. They don't, corporations are amoral.
They've got to fight for the cloud. I mean, you've got cloud companies right before you.
I agree that Google, and we've lost Matt because I would love to get his comment on this, but I would agree that I'm sure that Google, I would hope that Google understands that this is bad for Google. However, they are tied by the law from, doing as much as they might want to fight it. I like what you said. Companies are made of individuals. And if this goes against an individual's deepest values walk. That's maybe the – I mean, that's – I don't have hold hope for the board of directors of any big company to do anything. But the individuals who run that company, especially an engineering-driven company like Google –
I've got hope for Larry Page and Sergey Brin.
Yeah,
absolutely. And Mark Zuckerberg. I mean, I do, and I think, and I think that Mark Benioff, not to put now Kevin on the rare hot spot because usually it's Matt who's there, but Mark Benioff, you know, has helped make the cloud what it is, and it's in his interest to defend that cloud against forced lack of trust from companies and government.
Is he?
I don't know.
Okay. I think corporate politics is a complicated mix. Larry Page does not have free hand to do whatever he wants.
Well, but I honestly believe that Google has intuited for a long time that if we do the right thing for our users,
yes,
then the right things will happen in terms of engendering long-term loyalty.
And you feel that's still the core, yes, value of the company. I want to hear that. That's good.
Yes, I do believe that, and I completely agree. Google is composed of individuals who each have to make their own ethical decision, and I can't speak for other companies, and other companies have different cultures, but at least at Google, when Jeff is exactly right. You know, we have set ourselves a motto of don't be evil, and so people should call us on that when they think we're being evil. And when that resonates with individuals within the company, then we get the chance to bang the drum and make, mm-hmm, noise about that. And so I think giving, you know, the company's cover by criticizing us, calling us out when you think we're not doing the right thing, is exactly the best way to lobby the companies to take the action that you think they should be doing. And certainly at Google, I feel like we have a bent towards, you know, protecting our users and their security. And so looking for ways to make the defaults, you know, encrypted, for example, I think is something we have a long history of doing, and we'll probably keep thinking about ways to keep making Gmail secure and all those sorts of things.
Well, this is a good time for me then to bring in this filing in the class action data mining lawsuit, a filing from Google's attorneys in which they say, quote, this is Google talking about Gmail. Just as a sender of a letter to a business colleague cannot be surprised that the recipient's assistant opens the letter, people who used web-based email today cannot be surprised if their emails are processed by the recipient's email provider in the course of delivery. Indeed, a person has no legitimate expectation of privacy in information he voluntarily turns over to third parties.
That's been misquoted and misinterpreted like mad, and headline writers have gone berserk.
But that's the quote.
There's actually quotes within that. It's quoting previous cases. Read the next web piece.
I understand it. It's quoting Smith versus Maryland, a Supreme Court decision.
Right. And what it's saying is,
but he's quoting it to say this is what the Supreme Court said. So and this is in our argument and in our favor. Doesn't that say we embrace that statement as well?
No, it's in a specific case of, and I'm not that fully well-versed, but if you go to the next web story, it's a far better expression of this, that it's specific to a case involving whether or not Google, you know, the point is, what is the expectation of privacy here? Your ISP sees the metadata go back and forth. They know that that's there. Your secretary can open your mail, and so on and so on. And that was relevant in a limited discussion of a larger case, and it's been blown way out of proportion. And I know that I'm Google apologist often here, though I'm also pushing them hard on NSA. But in this case, this thing has been blown way, way out. It's beyond.
I think if you consider the source, a lot of this was coming from Consumer Watchdog, which, if you're a Google connoisseur,
I know they hate you.
You know,
guys.
Johnson said, and I don't know exactly why, but they, you know,
they don't like my
tracksuit.
Yeah,
and say Google is tracking you. They love to do stunts like they try to recreate the Google Wi-Fi and spy on members of Congress, like show up outside the members of Congress's homes to spy on them and say Google could have done this with their Wi-Fi. So. Consumer Watchdog is not what I would call an impartial source.
Well, but what is wrong? I mean, I'm still reading that quote in that brief, and maybe Google didn't say it, their lawyers did. But what's wrong with what they said? It is true. You cannot have expectation of privacy in a web-based email, right? Well,
okay.
Far be it for me to speculate as an engineer on a legal question, but hey, Google, don't fire me.
I mean, there is a privacy policy. Google has a privacy policy. And they are bound legally and morally to that privacy policy. But I think that they're making an argument that is not wrong, that if you are set, if you're, I've always said this, you put it on the internet, you cannot have an expectation that it is guaranteed private.
Let me read this from the next web. The case that Google is currently defending itself is a class action lawsuit arguing that Gmail's feature for scanning emails to target ads goes against wiretap laws. It's technically accurate that Google used the quote in its legal defense, but using that fact to claim that Google has completely given up on user privacy is both sensational and disingenuous. The company is, after all, bound by its own privacy policy. Google's use of the quote does make me uncomfortable, says the writer, especially in the current Snowden climate, but most of us already had this debate when Gmail first arrived in 2004. Google was open about using email content to serve ads at the time. They're being accused of that act being against wiretap, and they're saying that, whoa, that doesn't work because in that case, there was not that ironclad expectation of privacy, and people understood what they were doing with that. That's what this is about.
Okay.
Well, that sure was a conversation stopper.
Well, I mean, when the brief says, indeed, quote, and then quotes that the Supreme Court decision, a person has no legitimate expectation of privacy in information he turns over to third parties, indeed, is coming from Google. It's saying, yes, indeed, emphatically, that's correct. Now, they're defending a case, and lawyers are going to use every fact to defend the case. I don't think what they're saying is wrong. If you think that when you're using email, you have privacy, you're nuts. Yeah, when you turn your information over to third parties, you're turning it over to third parties, right?
Exactly. The sentence before that says people who use web-based email today can't be surprised if their emails are processed by the recipient's email provider in the course of delivery.
It's not all Gmail. It's every web step along the way.
Yeah, and in fact, it's especially ironic because Gmail has been quite good about trying to encrypt email, you know, between email providers, more so than anybody else.
Google's SMTP support, as we talked about on Security Now, supports encryption, whereas many SMTP providers do not.
So it's very
strange. Which is why it isn't encrypted, because in order to send an email to most people, it's unencrypted.
Right. So if you were to actually snoop on those connections, you could see unencrypted emails going by, whereas Gmail does better than anybody else that I know of off the top of my head in actually trying to transmit those emails in an encrypted fashion. So it's especially ironic to get skewered for privacy, you know, given those kinds of facts. But
this is actually a guy who says, I signed up. I mean, it's a BS lawsuit. I signed up when I was a minor and I didn't know any better. And here you are scanning my email. We talked about this before. If you have anti-spam, somebody's scanning your email because that's the only way you can prevent spam, as Matt Cutswell knows. You can't imagine what's inside and say, I think it might be spam. You have to look.
Which is also part of my argument with Bruce, that there is a gradation and a difference here. I enter into a transaction with a company knowingly saying this is what's going on, and I have the ability to leave it. Yeah. With government, that's not the case.
Right. Although, at this point, if you're using the internet, you're using so many interlocking companies that are, you know, you should assume your choice is not to not use Gmail. Your choice is not to use the internet. Really?
Yeah. Well, your choice is also not to talk to people. You know, at the end of the day, what's going to get violated is when somebody.
Yeah, don't go CCs outside. There might be cameras. You know, I mean, but that gets down to the question I always end up at is, well, what the hell do we do about it? Do you go with Scott McNeely and say, just give up? Privacy's dead?
No.
I don't have a huge hope that we can convince our Congress to, you know, somehow judiciously change the. It's such a fine parsing to say, well, we want some security, but we also want some privacy, and you guys figure it out. It's not. I don't know if, A, they have the capability or the motivation to do that. So I don't have a lot of hope that we can do anything about it.
But my biggest fear then is that if we lose trust in the net, if individuals lose trust and if companies lose trust in the net and in this whole notion of the cloud, then that's going to affect our jobs, all of us, but it also affects the economy.
Here's what I would say. I think you're a fool. Then this is what I'm saying about this Gmail story. You're foolish if you think it's private. It's not. So it's far better to be a realist about what it is and isn't. The internet is a public sphere. It's like you're in a mall. You're in public. And the only way it's going to work is if we're realists about it. It's un.
Do you, where do you put your company accounts?
On the internet, we use QuickBooks Online.
Right.
Well, and I think you have to look at every company's track record and make your choices. And one of the good things that's going to come out of the whole Snowden situation is people will be a lot more aware, and maybe privacy will be more of a factor in people's equations. And I think that's an entirely good thing. I mean, in some sense, it feels like some of the tech companies got thrown under the bus because, you know, right. there were claims that then people had to back off of. But if that ends up galvanizing Silicon Valley or galvanizing a large fraction of the populace to be aware of these issues, ultimately, that's a really good thing.
Oh, I think these conversations need to be had. I don't have a whole lot of hope that there'll be a positive outcome.
how about this, though? Do you remember, right, with SOPA, right? We managed to turn back what would have been a really bad law with about a month or two of, you know, the net starting to self-organize.
And I think it's kind of like 300 Spartans turning back part of the Persian army. There's a whole another army coming.
There is, but we have reinforcements, too. So my argument would be, way
you're
back
trying to
in
be like
SOPA.
Kevin Marks, be historical and smart.
Well, I saw the movie.
But in the SOPA days, we said, look, within 20 years, the people who are in Congress will have a much better idea about how the internet works, and they'll be much less likely to make, you know, legislative mistakes and bad laws and bad regulations about the internet. Because anyone with a Facebook account who's been, you know, using the internet since they were born, they have a much different conception of how the internet works. So we kind of have to defend the net for another 10 or 15 years, and then you won't have people who, you know, have their email printed out by secretaries on paper and bring it to them and don't understand how laws really work.
Right. God,
if we can just get to there, I think we'll be mostly safe.
Well, I think we're already at least partly there, but a big chunk of this is changing the sort of cultural expectations about what things are and how they behave, and that is the bigger, trickier part. And people like Jeff and Bruce, who talk about this in public all the time, are a key part of that in terms of making it clear and coming up with different narratives that other than. There are scary people out there, and we need to track everything on them and reconstruct these in different ways. And you know, we've seen that happen with the patent stuff. With patents, there was this historic narrative of little inventor against the big company, and the big company will always lose. And that has been exploited by the patent trolls for a couple of decades. But we're actually seeing a change in mindset now. In mm-hmm. public narrative around that, because people are starting to see the damage that's been done there. I think the same, definitely what we've seen with Snowden and Manning is that narrative has got a bigger hold on the public. There's still a lot of genius surveillance narrative out there. There are programs, you know, TV programs like Spooks and Person of Interest, that basically glorify spying on everyone as a force for good, and that, you know, that's a problematic, you know, structural narrative that's out there, and it's also one that is taken advantage of by the security services, you know, the NSA types, GCHQ types as well, to say, well, if you knew what we knew, then you'd trust us. Look, we convinced Obama. When he came into office, he didn't believe this. And there's a lot of, you know, self-regarding. There's this sort of weird psychological effect that if you're told something came from secret information, you're more likely to believe it than if you actually got, you know, public information to back it up.
Oh, isn't that good? That's, I like that. It's true.
I like that too. That's true.
Yeah.
And that, and
I also,
that,
I also
that
like
is,
the cultural piece of this.
These groups.
The cultural piece of this is interesting. You know, I joked on Google Plus that I expect on this season of Homeland, Kerry is going to use X key score and read all our emails and then go off and find Snowden and schnoop him.
hey, that show I'd watch.
Yeah.
But they did that in the first series. The first or second episode, she illegally planted cameras in his house.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Surveil him.
That's right.
Yes.
And we rooted for her as she's watching him make love to his wife.
Yeah.
God. There's more than one reason there, Leo, but yeah.
No, but seriously, that Hollywood has some complicity in this too, don't they?
Well, yeah. It's interesting to see how many movies we've seen with dystopian futures recently. You know, you start with Enemy of the State 10 years ago, and you get, you know, more and more dystopian. And I think that's partly reflecting popular culture, and partly that might shape popular culture. So
So let's get some movies and TV shows celebrating privacy. See, privacy is boring. Somebody already in the chat room said, I know this is important, but this is the least entertaining episode of Twig ever.
Oh, dear. Oh. So one book you might try reading is Cory Doctorow's Little Brother.
Oh, it's such a good one. Yeah. And that's entertaining.
It's entertaining, and it makes you realize the web should be encrypted, and that would solve a lot of problems.
And Homeland.
But, you know, the problem with that then is there, and I've said this before on the show, but there are services that Google gives me because it can read my email. It can give me that boarding pass. It can remind me of the meeting. It knows that I want that. Most of my life is banal. It's fine. So I don't want to have to. I don't want us all to become hermits in cottages like the Unabomber, away from all the world. I like that we can connect. That's why I wrote a book called Public Parts, on sale now, because it connects us, right? And if you can have
a private connection with Google and keep the government out of it. I think what Matt's saying.
No, I don't think you can.
Well, for instance, I'll give you an example, Matt. And I like what you said. Encrypt everything, and in fact, Google does use HTTPS. They use SSL encryption. But then there's the issue of the NSA stores everything encrypted or not. I think that we know that XKeyscore told us that. And then the NSA coming to Google and saying, you know those expired SSL keys, the ones you don't use anymore? Let's get those. And Google, we don't know, but Google, we believe, has been asked for those. And, of course, if it's an NSL, cannot say. And may indeed hand that over. So maybe they don't know exactly what I'm saying today, but even if I've encrypted it, they might know what I said 6 months ago.
I think that was one of the main reasons why Google was one of the first to adopt perfect forward secrecy.
Yay!
Yeah, sets up different keys such that, you know, if you can record a conversation and then decrypt it 6 years later, that might still have an impact. But if the keys change every single session, then, you know, and those keys go away, then there's nothing that you can do about it.
And by the way, if anybody has any doubts that Google wants to protect you going forward, perfect forward secrecy, implementing that is proof, right? Because there's no business argument for that.
That's right.
It's just because...
Well, that's the interesting story that I'd love to have. Matt can't tell us or else we'd have to kill him. Is those changes that Google did make recently about encrypting and about going HTTPS and doing those things, how much those were motivated by what the government was doing? Why else would they do it, right?
We actually started doing encrypted.google.com in 2008, and one of the guys who did a lot of heavy lifting on that, his name is Evan, he actually reports to me, and we started that after I read Little Brother, and we said, look,
that's awesome, Matt. Does Corey know that?
I haven't talked to him about it, so I should send him a note.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Take that
chat room. That's entertaining as can be.
By the way, that underscores what we just said about Hollywood, which is... Yep. That, you know, fiction, which Little Brother is, whether it's books or movies or TV show, can influence where we go going forward.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love that.
And I think it really, so, you know, 5 years before all this controversy erupted, and I think the other, you know, to be fair, the other thing that made a big difference was the idea of the Chinese hackers back in 2009. So you put those two together, and suddenly I think Google got a little bit of a head start on realizing you really need to.
We may never know what Matt Cutts was going to say.
We didn't know that the NSA has a kill switch.
At 2:24:52 Pacific Daylight Time, Matt was frozen and never appeared again. we'll fix Matt Cutts. While we're doing that, let's take a break. Corey's got to know that because that's a great story. And for those who don't know what perfect forward secrecy is, it's complicated. I don't fully understand it, but the gist of it is what you just heard, which is it prevents this ability of the government to go back and ask for keys to prior conversations. And they have done that, we know. And so that is, to me, very encouraging. It means, at the very least, that the government, that the Google understands what you've been saying, Jeff, that it's good business to protect your users' privacy. I think they're just as likely doing it because people like Evan and Matt go, you know, nobody should be able to read that just because it's right. It's the right thing to do. And that's why I love engineers, because I think, heaven help us if a company ever becomes such a big business that the people who do the stuff, the engineers on the floor, don't get to express their ethical standards. Because I trust engineers. Not all of them.
That's the essence of don't be evil.
But that is the truly serious thing about the national security letters, which is that you are then forbidden for not only talking about the letter, but saying that you've received the letter or what's underway. The thing with the guy who shut his email service down. I forgot his name.
Ladar. Yeah.
Having to say, I'm not sure I can talk about that. I can't tell my lawyer about that.
Amazing.
I can't talk about this. That was the very Kafkaesque part of this.
Watch the Ladar Levinson interview on Democracy Now, and he's sitting there with his lawyer next to him, and the fine line that they have to narrow line they have to walk. What's great though, and Google's done this too, is you can, because now we know enough about PRISM and so forth, you can say just enough to not break the law, but to give people who are paying attention the information they need to know. And I think it's pretty clear what they asked him for. The way that LavaBit worked, we were talking about this with Steve Gibson. It was an encrypted store, and you used your own key. But of course, in order for email to work, it has to be decrypted on transport, since most SMTP does not support encryption. And so LavaBit had to have your key to the store. And Steve speculated, I think he's probably right based on what Ladar said, that the government was saying, okay, well, just give us the keys. And he said, I don't want to do this because I'm not going to fight it, but what I'm going to do is shut the whole thing down, erase the hard drives, then give them the keys.
But then I wonder if he's going to be, is he going to be accused of thus knowingly erasing evidence, destroying evidence?
Well, I'm sure that he's walking a very tight rope. And I do applaud is that instead of leaving the country, he's staying it out, and he's giving interviews, and he's doing the best he can to give us information. Let's take a break. We're going to get Matt Cutts back. Wait a minute. I see a little Matt Cutts.
I think I'm back. I'm sorry. You know, somebody's just like flipping the switch on the network or something.
Oh, no. We know who's in charge here. It's the NSA, so it's okay. let me do an ad anyway.
It's
we can get that
Times,
all that working. New York Times. Yeah, is the New York Times back? Yes, it is.
I believe so.
Yeah, I just checked it. So what, all morning, HTTP 1.1, nobody home. What the hell was that all about? Were they being hacked?
I wonder if they have a story up. I don't know.
Did somebody just flip a switch? Oops.
I think they said they did a service upgrade.
I hired a CTO. This is my worst hire ever. Because he seemed like he was bald, he was old, he had maturity. I was talking about hiring kids, and they were causing problems with my bosses. So I hired this guy, and the server room got too hot, and so he started turning off servers. I had to fire him very soon thereafter.
But he was comfortable. What were you gonna say, Kevin? About the Times, did they say what they said? What was going on?
There was a thing that they said.
Here's
they
an article.
Applied a service up like an upgrade patch, and then their system.
Yeah,
went down,
that's so the usual. It was a failure during regular maintenance of nytimes.com, and not the result of a cyber attack. Eileen Murphy, a spokeswoman for the New York Times company, gave this interview to the New York Times reporter Noam Cohen. The outage occurred within seconds of a scheduled maintenance update being pushed out. We believe that was the cause. It went down 11:10 a.m. Eastern. Sporadically returned around 1:15 p.m. Boy, 2 hours outage for the New York Times. That's a long time.
So I just got this headline from the Washington Post, Compost, which is obvious they're a joke blog, but nonetheless. New York Times website goes down, panicked mobs stream into street demanding to know trends.
Where's my bits blog? The site had 7.1 million visits on Monday. So that's millions who were turned away. Although the Times has been, and they mentioned this in January, the Times reported that Chinese hackers had repeatedly attacked the website and it had in fact broken in. It must be hard. It's probably making Arthur Sulzberger think, do we really want to stop printing? Really?
That was what one comment was. The website's down, but don't worry, I printed it all out for you.
Here, look. I love it. Our show today brought to you by LegalZoom.com. We're not talking a law firm, despite the name. What we are talking is legal paperwork that can really make a difference in your business and in your personal life for a very low cost that you can do yourself at LegalZoom.com. And you wouldn't be alone. Millions of people have used LegalZoom.com. I think something like 12 million people over the last 12 years. It is National Make-A-Will Month. So August, yes. So now is the time. If you don't have a last will and testament, to get over to LegalZoom.com, they'll get you 15% off your last will. Offer does end soon. Don't waste time. Your life might be ending soon, and it would be nice to have a will. If you don't, well, then the government decides what happens to your money, your kids, your assets. You can do so many things at LegalZoom.com. LLC, incorporation, trademark. If you've already got a will, let me point you at the healthcare, durable healthcare power of attorney. Really a good thing to have. So that if you are incapacitated, somebody you trust is making medical decisions for you. You might assume that that's, my next of kin will be able to do that. No. So you can make this very simply. You can do a living will. In fact, if you want, if you go to LegalZoom.com, you can do a living trust, and they will give you a pour-over will absolutely free. Here's what I want you to do. Visit LegalZoom.com. Use the offer code TWIG. You'll get $10 off any service, 15% off a living or a will or a living will. It's National Make-A-Will Month. This is really a good kind of stimulus to get you doing this. And by the way, LegalZoom, most of this stuff you can do yourself, but if you want help from an attorney, they've negotiated, I think this is so great, fixed rate legal plans with attorneys in your state who can give you advice at a cost it's not going to get out of spiral out of control. You choose the attorney based on their profile and unedited user reviews. I love LegalZoom. You will too. LegalZoom.com. Make that will. Durable power of health attorney, is really important. All of that stuff. LegalZoom.com. We're talking Twig with Matt Cutts of the Google. He's the man in charge of fighting web spam, keeping those search results clean and beautiful, sparkling, fresh and new, smelling like linen on
minty
a summer
fresh
day.
Minty smelling like fresh. Kevin Mark's backyard.
Yeah, Kevin always does it from his garden. I'm going to say garden because he's British. It's beautiful out there.
It's pretty nice out there.
Yeah, Kevin Mark's at Salesforce, but he's been everywhere, including the Google itself, as well as are you sad to see Chris Messina move on?
In some ways, I'm glad to see him move on because he's going to be able to talk a bit more, because one of the challenges he had there was he didn't get to speak as much.
So. Chris, like you, an advocate for open standards, for APIs, for making the world a better place, and that's kind of what he was doing at Google.
Right.
He's quite famously the guy who created the first hashtags on Twitter.
Yes.
An advocate for open web. He was on the board of OpenID and the Open Web Foundation. Founded BarCamp. Great guy. He's not dead. It sounds like I'm eulogizing him. He's still alive, folks. He's just leaving the Google. And he's going to a startup now. Is that right?
Yes.
An art startup, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's cool. Good for him. I always liked Chris a lot, and I think the work he did at Mozilla and at Google was really valuable. Promoting the open web, which is kind of what you're all about, Kevin. That's why I bring it up. Also here, Jeff Jarvis. He's a professor of journalism at the City University of New York, and his blog is buzzmachine.com. If you're just tuning in, Gina has the day off. She'll be back, I hope, next week. She's fine. You want to look inside the TARDIS? Did you see this?
That's the geekiest thing ever.
You guys at Google.
It's Comic-Con every day there.
It's Comic-Con every day. So you have to go to a specific place in Google Maps, right? Walk me through this because I've not done this before. So I click the link and I am at – wait a minute. No, that's where I am right now. So that can't be where the TARDIS is. Let me click that link again.
Oh, it could be. We thought you were the next Doctor Who.
Try opening up in your browsers incognito. There, you got it. Okay. Yeah. So when you do Street View in this location, which looks like it's London, right, you'll see a pretty traditional blue call box, police call box. Do they still have those in London?
Very few.
Very few.
Yeah.
They did it when Doctor Who started in the 60s because they were very common at the time. And, of course, it made a perfect place for a Time Lord, a perfect disguise for a Time Lord's spaceship. Now, you got to click the double. See the double chevron? You might have to do up arrow if you have the new maps. Oh, my God! It's bigger on the inside. If you're not a Whovian, this will make no sense or be of any interest. But look at that.
Have they got the whole TARDIS, just the control room?
There's more?
There's a swimming pool. There's a library. There's the bedrooms that they had. Yeah, I'm not sure they've actually got them here, but the actual...
Well, go down those steps. See if we can go through the door there. Oh, my. Oh, my.
No,
So is this like a 20%? Would this count as a 20% project, Matt? Or,
yeah, I suspect so. It's a nice Easter egg. And I think that this plus the model number on the Chromecast was the other Easter egg I liked about the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
We loved that. Yeah, it was a HG. What was the model number? Is H2G2 and 42 or something like that.
Yeah. 42, yeah.
Yeah, I love that. By the way, thank you for the... I don't know why I'm thanking you, Matt, but nice job on the Chromecast. I just love that thing.
It's a really nice device. Yeah, it's the whole idea that you can fit a little tiny computer in $35 worth of, you know, plastic is pretty crazy.
So pretty much sold out everywhere, unless you go to eBay and spend $100 on it.
I should sell one of my spare ones.
Oh, yeah, I bought five. I probably should.
You probably got at least five TVs there.
Oh yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. No, I have three of my TVs, and I got two for Lisa because she's got two. I didn't put on every TV, but most of them. It's cool. I use it because I play Google Play Music, and then when I bought Breaking Bad, this is why it's just brilliant. Instead of buying it on Amazon or iTunes, I bought it on Google Play because now I can go over to her house and we can play it off my phone.
Very easy and pretty clever. Just makes it really convenient.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Yeah. Pretty neat stuff. Where is this? Is this telephone box? Is this in London? Looks like it's England. Yeah, there's a underground station next to it.
What's the station? Can you read it?
I don't know. Can you read it, Chad? On the
oh sure
Earl's Court. So it's London.
Earl's Court. Okay. Right.
Is that accurate, Kevin? Is that where it normally is?
Is there actually a police box there?
I'm assuming there actually is a police box there.
Isn't that funny? So what that is like a phone booth for a Bobby to use?
Yeah. I mean, it's actually originally holding cells, I think. The idea
what?
Is you could lock someone in them briefly while you... there was also a phone in them you could call for assistance.
That's so funny. Excuse me, sir. Would you mind stepping in here? Goodbye. You've now been transported to the 28th century. Okay. Google Play revenue is going well, up 67% over the last 6 months. A lot of it, by the way, in Asia. What's your experience with the Play Store? I don't find that everything I want is in there. HBO so far has only tapped Amazon and Apple, I think.
I've been using it for the music.
I love the music.
And that's pretty good. Though it needs better metadata for classical. It's actually quite hard to find like Beethoven symphonies and things.
Well, I agree. I type Mozart and I keep getting those damn operas.
but also there's lots of variations on there, but they're all like 100 best Mozart tracks. It's like, no, just give me the Deutsche Grammophon catalog, please.
Right. So I can, exactly.
You know, find the ones I want. But also, when it's even playing on the screen, they're truncating the movements and things, so you can't actually read which one it is.
Nothing worse than a truncated movement.
Oh my! You know, but the problem with classical is you need way more metadata. You need the composer. And
I think there's actually literally something wrong with me.
That's awesome. Truncated movement.
It's just, no, there's really something wrong with my brain. Top five revenue generating apps on Google Play. Candy Crush Saga number one. Now that's, oh, you like that. Oh, thumbs up. One of our studio audience members apparently captured by the Candy Crush Then something from Gung Ho Online Entertainment that looks like it's in that's Japanese. Puzzles and Dragons. Number three, a Korean title that I can't read. And number four, Line, which I think is Line. Is that Line 2? Line Corporation. Number five, another one from Kakao, a Korean company. Top five revenue generating apps: Candy Crush Saga, Clash of Clans, Heyday, Puzzles and Dragons, all games. The Hobbit Kingdoms of Middle Earth. So yeah, and this is the App Store, but the revenue on the App Store is not caught up with Apple, but it's growing. Apple was up 15%.
Well, that's the argument I always get when I yell at media companies for building iOS first instead of Android. I say, how snotty can you be? What are you doing here? And they say, well, but the revenue's bigger.
Not much longer. Yeah,
but they're not normally charging for their apps, are they?
Yeah, that's part of it. A lot of the apps are free. I think
some of them are. Okay,
yeah, I think it's still mostly that the developers really like developing for iOS. And I think that's going to change. Even Fred Wilson, just today, I think, in a blog post, said that Apple's got to be a little bit worried. Now, we know that Carl Icahn's bullish on Apple. But who is it?
I love the headline. It was like, 77-year-old knows how to use Twitter pretty well.
Just unbelievable. And then the stock market goes crazy because Carl Icahn says, yeah, I'm bullish on Apple. And it goes up like 10% or something.
And it's up again today.
It's like these people, well, if you listen to the stock market, clearly that's not the place to get your technology information. But Fred Wilson, who was an Android fan, makes a very good point. He says, I don't want a one-horse race. And at this point, Android and Google is about to run the table.
Yeah.
And that Apple better sit up and do something here. Some say a cheap iPhone. I don't know if that's the key. It might be worldwide where they don't have phone subsidies. Fred says, I sure hope Apple does announce and ship a cheap iPhone that prepaid users can purchase for less than $200. I don't think that's going to happen. I hope Apple takes the steps it must take to maintain its market share and grow it outside the U.S.,
As of Friday, you can buy a Firefox phone on eBay for $85.
Wow.
Yes, I'm looking forward to getting one of those.
Did you order it?
Goes on sale.
Coming soon.
Okay.
A few people have got them already, but my friends at Mozilla have had them for a while, but they've got new ones coming. But they'll be shipping them abroad first. The goal is not for this to be a massive high-end phone. They're competing with the feature phones primarily. So it's not designed to be as high-end as iOS or the higher end of Android. It's designed to be the feature phone and web-based.
It's democratic.
And the idea is that you should be able to run the web-based apps on your Android or iOS as well. So that's the sort of principle behind it.
I think for HTML5 now might be mature enough that you really could see a credible web app.
It's a trade-off. It depends what you're trying to do. So there was a huge somebody wrote this long article about why mobile will always need to be native, which came down to JavaScript performance and garbage collection stuff. And what that one said to me was, we need to put more high-level abstractions into the HTML standard so that you're not trying to write this stuff in JavaScript.
Right.
If you've got WebGL abstractions, you're not trying to do 3D modeling in JavaScript.
Right.
And so on. So the what we're seeing in the web platforms, that's actually what's happening. We've now got a good set of rich abstractions for doing lots of things that you can then wire together with a little bit of script. And that's what we what enables it. You need to write a native app for certain kinds of things, but the sort of set of what you can do with the HTML platform has been growing and growing over time, and that's a very encouraging trend.
You're using your Pixel still, right, Jeff Jarvis?
Yes, I am indeed. It has done it got wonky. And it does slow down some pages, like you were experiencing from the beginning. I don't know what's going on. I rebuilt it. I'm trying to switch to the stable channel.
You have to be on the developer channel right now because you were using Skype. You've stopped, though.
I was, but I went ahead and went off that, and I went to the beta channel. I even got someone to go to stable. But I also saw the developer channel just today came out with a new version that lets you very easily go back and forth between versions. It was impossible to go back. But now you can go back and forth between versions. You have to wipe the machine when you do it, but that's the great thing about it. I thought, it's quick. Getting wonky.
Right.
90 seconds, it's rebuilt.
So this is one of four new features on the developer channel. Actually, I think I'm going to – I've been staying in stable, but I think I'm going to maybe try doing this because I love this idea. So you can bypass the image recovery process. A power wash will allow you to change the channel from stable to beta to developer unstable. You'll have to power wash, but you know that just means you know fully refreshing it. But how long does that take? 30 seconds, 45 seconds? Not very
about
long.
About 90 seconds. 90. All that you lose is if you do like capture a screenshot right. And capture it to local memory. That's
I feel guilty every time I save something to the Pixel. Like yeah. I'm going to run out of I'm going to run out. I feel like
Matt,
I shouldn't be saving it.
Are you using the Pixel?
Who me?
I really enjoy my Pixel.
Oh, Matt, yeah. Are you on
I'm
a Pixel?
Still using it. I am, and I did a 30-day challenge in May, and I never stopped using my Pixel. So, hello there.
Oh, you did that one. Oh, that's right. That's right. I forgot that. Yes. Yes. So you didn't stop then. Same here. I mean, I did it as kind of a challenge 1 week. I don't have as much patience as you do, but it went on longer.
So there's a new – are you on developer, Matt? You probably are, huh?
I'm actually on beta because I use it for my day-to-day work, so I figure I'll go stay pretty stable.
I'm tempted to go to developer just for these new features. See all open tabs in Windows with one button click. I love that. That's like expose on the Macintosh.
There's a Chrome plugin that does that.
Just really?
Three fingers.
Oh, all right. Touch-based drag and drop. That's kind of really cool. Is that within a page?
Yeah, but it's only for the Pixel, obviously, because the Pixel's the only one that has...
Yeah, you got to have touch. It's not going to be on the other Chrome OS, yeah. That's pretty sweet.
Mine has been getting wonkier, crashing more, and I don't know if it's the latest build, so that's why I changed the channel. There's nothing that can get cruffed up in the machine, right?
Yeah. Really. What could possibly go wrong?
Not really, but I do love the idea that you could completely rebuild the machine... Just log into Chrome Sync and you're good to go.
To me, that's the single reason to even look at a Chrome OS device, frankly. You give up so much from like my, you know, the Pixel's the same as a MacBook Air. You give up all of that stuff. But what you gain is this kind of rock solid stability.
Yes.
And the ability to just power wash it. And so
my dad actually visited for a week and he had a 5-year-old Mac laptop, so we were going to get him a new Mac laptop. And so I gave him a Chromebook to kind of tide him over in the meantime. And he logged in, and he had all his bookmarks.
Yeah,
so
isn't
by
that
the time
nice?
We got, by the time we got to the Apple store, he was like, well, son, this computer is 10 times as much than this $250 computer. So why don't I use the $250 computer one, and I can buy 5 of them, you know?
Good. Yeah.
Make that's, an argument. Yeah.
No, that there's the use case.
My son's moved to using the Chromebook full time.
Really?
His school stuff. Yeah. It was partly because he had a PC that he dropped and smashed, and I gave him the Chromebook, and then got the older Mac out and set that up for him. But he switched to that, and he finds it plenty useful for, he does all his most of his stuff is web based. He uses Google Docs for his writing.
Right.
He's been doing a lot of Coursera and things. So he's been impressed with that.
I tell you, when you add last, school, go ahead.
His school has now required them that they all get an iPad, so they can use digital textbooks, which is
that's interesting. Yeah.
And actually, the iPad 4 screen is actually good enough to reproduce a physics textbook.
Oh yeah, it looks good.
Right enough. So that's a step in the right direction.
Well, in fact, Google Play is just this was promised at the breakfast with Sundar, and now is out. Textbook support and book rental capabilities into the Play Store. And I have to say, if you have a to me, the school would be better off buying a Nexus 7. I guess it depends what textbooks are available and so forth. But
yeah,
a Nexus 7 also more than enough resolution.
Right. And, well, you can use Google Play and Amazon and Apple Book iBooks all on the iPad. So
that's right. There's an advantage there. Yeah.
Every day, I swear, this is I'm sad, but every day I sign on and I go to Play and I click on the Nexus 7, hoping the LTE is going to be there. And every day I'm disappointed. I wish they'd just tell me when.
I mean, I did try this in the future. You will be happy.
In the future, we'll all be happy. That's the nature of the future.
Matt, what phone are you using?
I can neither confirm nor deny.
Oh!
That I have a
I know exactly what phone he's using. He's doing the little twist, yes. Twist.
Oh, it's so nice whenever I run my Pocket Casts to listen to This Week in Google. Oh, I have to say, the Moto X, I've always been a Nexus kind of guy, but the extra stuff that the Moto X does is actually really good, so I'm very conflicted right now. So.
I went out and bought a Nexus 4 just so I could compare the two.
What do you think, Leo? How do you compare them?
Well, I prefer the Moto X. It's a little smaller in the hand. It's funny, the Moto X, the reason people go crazy about this and they hate it that I like it is because, you know, well, wait a minute, the stats, the specs, what are you, crazy? This is not, but it's really more of a gestalt, the feeling in the hand. It's smaller than the Nexus 4 with roughly the same resolution screen. And it feels lighter in the hand. You know, I admit that the OK Google Now and the dictation are hit and miss enough that you're not going to rely on it. But there's little subtle things. The camera flip is bigger than one might think. The fact that you can have authenticated Bluetooth locales that the phone is unlocked that's a surprisingly useful thing.
It really is. Hopefully some of this will get folded into the main part of, you know, the main chunk of Android.
Yeah, and I do feel that people who want a pure Google experience will be pretty happy with a Moto X. Yeah. Aside from the camera app and a few of these additional features, it is Google experience. It's very Googly. In fact, I decided to run my Moto X with it. I usually put a Nova launcher on all my Android devices. But I decided to just try it with plain old Android 4.3. And it's great.
Yeah.
Here's a question for you.
It's buttery. And battery life, what are you getting?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness. I was going to say, the one thing that has been crazy about the battery life is it sips it like you wouldn't believe, like in a very good way. Like, there was a closed sale where we were doing Square, and so I had the phone on all day to run credit cards to help people out for this close swap. And at the end of the day, I was at 50% battery life. And
it's kind of mind-boggling when that happens.
Yeah. The fact that you can have the OK Google Now work and still have the battery life kind of blows my mind. I'm really impressed by it.
I know better than predicting what consumers are going to do, because you can't. And I don't know, you know, people don't buy the best phone in anybody's mind. They buy whatever phone they buy. But I think from a point of view of users, if they get a chance to hold and try the Google Google Moto X, it is probably the most consumer-friendly phone there is out there. It is the one to get. Now, I'm very curious what Apple's going to do with the iPhone, next iPhone.
September 10th, right?
We'll find out. Yep.
But it's great to have
all
this
question.
I
need to replace this one because I smashed it.
What is that one?
This is the Galaxy Nexus.
Galaxy.
Yes.
Okay.
That's what I was just using until
a classic. A classic.
Yeah. But it's got like a shattered screen, actually, do that.
Like a 1959 Cadillac Eldorado.
Exactly. Like, suicide doors, baby.
But one of the things I want is I want it to take a full size SIM so I can take it to the UK and plug random SIMs into it easily, which I think rules out the Moto.
It's a nano SIM.
Yeah.
And so that leaves me with, you know, do I go for the S4?
I saw a story recently about a SIM vending machine, I think in Heathrow, where you got both nano and micro on the same package.
I think we're moving towards nano.
Okay,
I really
maybe,
do.
Maybe it'll get there. Yeah.
And I have a cutter. By the way, you can cut a. You can cut them.
Those don't work very well, right?
No, they do.
Yeah.
If you have the right cutter. And there are cutters that cut down to nano, and they still work, which I don't understand because you're cutting off metal contacts. I don't understand how it works at all. But I'm not saying you should keep that in mind. And I think the Galaxy S4 Google Edition or the would be a good choice, or the HTC One.
Right. Yeah.
I was
between those.
Yeah. I carry them all, and I just can't decide. It's one of those things where there is no perfect phone, but I'm starting to think that there is this kind of Zen state you go into with the Moto X, where it's just enough. It's not a lot of phone. It's just enough phone that there's something appealing about it.
Yeah, I've been.
So here's my question.
Go ahead.
I got a question. So I want to buy the. I want it, right? I will not go on contract.
Good.
I also want an unlocked phone.
Yep.
So if I buy it on AT&T, I can buy it full price, AT&T policy, I think, is if you have no contractual obligation, they will unlock it.
If you're in good standing, even if you do have a contractual obligation, they say they will unlock it. They're not required
to. Okay.
But that's still going to have AT&T cruft. You know, there will be a Google Play edition.
You were quoted.
Yeah.
You were quoted.
Okay. So here's what Guy Kawasaki, I have it in writing. They're not going to do a Google edition because then it wouldn't be a Moto X, because what makes the Moto X a Moto X is those three or four things. But it's so close to pure Google that they're still going to sell it on the Google Play Store, just not a Google edition. You see what I'm saying?
Right, but there will be added AT&T cruft on the AT&T version?
Yeah, it's not much. It's two programs.
Yeah. I think it's like two apps, and then you can disable them, and then you won't see them.
Yeah, I never really – it's not like it's taking up a lot of space or anything.
Because the reason I could buy the AT&T one is I can do the customized, I have a purple phone, and I can get more memory.
That is a big issue, yeah. Because I think basically I'm not going to buy a Moto X till I can get a wooden back.
That's going to be awesome.
I know. So that means later this year. I mean, maybe December. I don't know. They said end of Q4. So I think that's when Motorola's exclusivity ends. I don't think it lasts. I mean, I have no knowledge of this. You know, I think I keep getting quoted as if I know something. I don't know nothing. You know, Guy Kawasaki said, why'd you say it cost $350 to make? I said, I didn't say it. Goldman Sachs said it. I'm just quoting Goldman Sachs. But unfortunately, all of these stupid blogs quote me as if I'm saying it. I'm quoting an analyst who said that. I don't know. How would I know how much it cost? They think Guy told me.
It sucks to be the president of the internet. In
I'm like Obama. I know nothing. They don't tell me anything.
He's the Sergeant Schultz of the internet.
I know nothing. however, I do like the Moto X. I kind of still think it's a world beater. You never know what consumers are going to go for. It's subtle. That's part of the problem. Is it kind of is a subtle appeal. You don't know that the battery life is so great till you use it for a couple of weeks and you realize this is just keeps going.
Yeah. And I'm an Nexus fanatic. I would always go vanilla.
Right.
And the add-ons have actually impressed me quite a bit. So that takes a lot for me to leave the Nexus.
It's pretty pure, right, Matt? I mean,
very pure.
That's why I got the Nexus 4. I wanted to compare 4.3 to, and you know, it's only 4.22, although I wouldn't be surprised if they got 4.3 and before, you know, it hasn't come out yet.
Right.
So, Kevin, what are you going to get?
I don't know. I'm going to kind of look, but I'm leaning towards the HTC One.
It's a beautiful phone.
Play edition.
Battery life is very challenging on that thing. You got to nurse it.
Okay. And it's not exchangeable batteries, is it?
No, that's the advantage of the GS4.
Okay.
Exchangeable batteries. I would not get the Samsung. You know the. Cruftware version, I would get the Google Play edition because it
of all the phones,
it has no memory. You know, it's only 16 gigs, and 12 of them are used by, you know, watch your eyes go like this. I mean, who cares? Wave your hand. It's got so much junk on it. I've never seen a worse junked up phone in my life, and it's not the carriers. It says Samsung.
But
what do you? I think Samsung is about to abandon Android.
Nah.
Well, there's certainly stories that talk about them wanting to do Tizen and stuff, but you know that
they have three OSs. Exactly. They have three OSs. They've got Tizen, which is a Linux.
Lada.
They've got a Windows Phone, the Ative series. They've got Android.
Somebody's going to buy BlackBerry too.
And they know they'll probably do a Firefox OS one as well. I think their point is they want to do all the things.
Yeah, that's how Samsung's thing. Wait,
they're not a focused company. They make everything.
We'll do whatever you want.
So I got to visit Korea a couple of years ago, and I got to ride in a Samsung car. I didn't realize they made cars. So that's the full scale.
It's a
stack.
It's a Keiretsu. They do everything. They make bulldozers. Yeah. They make washing machines, refrigerators, 1,800 different versions of the Galaxy phone.
So I'm waiting for the Google bulldozer or the Google washing machine. Yeah.
I just Samsung's having a developer conference, which is very to me intriguing in the fall.
They had one last year for Tizen in San Francisco.
Right. This doesn't say Tizen specifically.
Okay.
Speaking of developer conferences, there's also one announced for Chrome.
That's fun. I'd go to that.
Yeah, it's on the Chrome Dev Summit in November.
Is that a Google event?
Yes.
I think so, yes.
Yes.
Well, who else?
On the rundown under Google.
I guess Chromium, the Chromium folks could be doing it, but no, it's a Google event. Okay.
Which is probably, I think, the more development we get on Chrome apps and stuff, the better.
People are reporting numerous problems with the Nexus 7. Some say the multi-touch is buggy. Some say their GPS is not locking. Others say it's flashing on and off, rebooting. I haven't had any trouble with mine, but that's anecdotal. So I don't know
Google's
how...
Google's acknowledged the problem with the multi-touch. Right. And is looking into the problem with the GPS, I think, is what they've said.
I use it all the time. What's the story? Maybe you can help us, Matt, on this one. I know it's not your division, but the fight over the factory images and Jean well, Baptiste Clairu.
Yeah, JBQ is an awesome guy. He's the basically the main engineering lead maintainer of the Android open source project. And so as part of that, you're always dealing with, you know, OEMs and various manufacturers trying to get as much of the source code and firmware open as possible. And that can be a challenge because sometimes, you know, an OEM might consider firmware or binaries to be proprietary. And so I think he got a little bit frustrated trying to make sure that you can have a phone that booted all the way up and had as much hardware functional as possible. And so I think he's maybe taking a break from the Android open source project. So we'll see how that goes. But you know,
but meanwhile, the version did come out for the Nexus 7, I think.
It did. It did. So I don't, I'm not privy to what the negotiations were and that sort of thing. It's always a challenge because you're picking months in advance and you're trying to figure out how to get things open source, but you also have to get the device out. And so there's a lot of different factors you have to balance there.
Do you think it's Qualcomm? I mean, the blame has fallen on Qualcomm. I don't know. Is that fair?
That's what the reports have been.
Yeah.
That's what the external, like Android Police and the people who have studied,
right.
You know, the levels of frustration, which you can graph, you know, of JBQ, seem to point in that direction.
You know what I love about this, though? This shows what you were saying, Jeff, is that even a corporation as big as Google, individuals still can stand up for doing what they believe in. Mm-hmm. And yep. You kind of have to – that's great.
Yep. And have a big impact. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, have a big impact. Nevertheless, I think the Nexus 7 is fabulous. I'm glad they got the images out. That's really cool. And I hope Qualcomm just – chill, man. Take a chill pill. It's going to be okay.
I want my LTE.
And get the LTE. Please, Jeff's waiting.
I will pass that feedback on.
I always expect you to do, Matt. Yes.
Esther Dyson is going to be our guest in Triangulation. That's going to be a lot of fun. What a legend she is. And any questions you want to give me, Jeff, or anybody else for Esther, I'll be glad to pass along. That's coming up in just a few
minutes. Ask her if she's
cleaned
up her desk.
I've seen pictures of her office. Esther ran ICANN for a while, so we can talk a lot about internet governance, absent government influence. Of course, her adventures, one of the early tech investors. I mean, she's big into genetic genome research, one of the first 10 people to donate her genome publicly to the Public Genome Project. Lots of interesting things we're going to talk about with Esther Dyson in just a little bit. I'm just looking if there's anything else.
There's an amazing – have you seen the Kid's Guide to the Internet, Leo?
No, I haven't.
Oh, you must. It's on. It's under Other. It's you can.
Other's
you
where all the best stuff is.
Part of it.
All right.
this was made I thought this had to be a joke. Lauren Weinstein said no, it's not. Because he looked at all the stuff. It's pretty amazing.
It's old, though, right? This is not
It's
new.
Old. It's 90s.
Adjust the VCR tracking for clearest picture. That might be a giveaway.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was a hack.
That's a bad sign.
If it is, man, it just took a lot of work.
You Hometown Television presents. Well, I just want to see the beginning. I always like to. I wonder. I might have worked on this. I don't know.
You could have been dad.
Yeah.
On the internet, cyberspace. Hello, virtual reality. Interactive appetite. Searching for a website. A window to the world. Got to get online.
Take Come on, Kevin.
In with the techno set. You're going surfing on the internet.
Yeah. I've done shows like this. I got to tell you.
Is that the prisoner
phone? Hey there,
phone?
It's us again. This is my brother Peter.
Wait a minute. Hey, wait a minute. Have we met you before? Hey there, it's us again? Huh? Okay.
We're the Millers.
By the way, she's 48 now. And, okay.
It's Andrew and Lisa, the basics
internet ruined her life.
And yeah. I thought you might want to come along.
She's a little bit of a drinking problem, but otherwise...
When we installed internet access on our computer, I got the whole family involved.
It's true. Everybody had their own tasks to do.
It was a lot of work, but it was really worth it.
Now that I've gotten on the internet, I'd rather be on my computer than doing just about anything.
It's really cool.
Well,
the internet gave us a whole world of...
You know, there's naked ladies on it.
So I guess this is a story of how it changed our lives. Maybe it will yours, too, with the kid's guide to the internet.
Take a spin, now you're in with the techno set. You're going to turn on the internet.
Who is this aimed at?
As Rich told you, we installed the internet on our computer just a short time ago.
I wonder how do you install the internet?
We installed the internet on our computer just a short time ago.
Oh, man.
And already is laden with viruses, spyware, and malware.
Oh,
and Dad's getting the Viagra spam every minute.
I don't know how to play the typical computer games that all the kids enjoy, but their curiosity for learning has skyrocketed.
Oh, yeah.
Peter is constantly quoting
Dad, I'd like to go into the room, my bedroom now and learn some more on the internet, if you don't mind.
Anatomy is my favorite subject.
Surfing spots around the globe.
Not to mention the improvement in Peter's grades, and Dasha's, too. Having the internet in our home has had a great impact on our lives. Rich keeps up with the stock market and our investments, and I'm able to pay the bills in half the time.
He has a few secret cyber affairs on the side.
Dad's been very busy. He says he has an internet nickname, Carlos Danger. Look at the Netscape browser. I love the navigator.
The next thing you'll type will be specific. Directing you to a particular website, like
MTV, a co-producer of this, by the way.
Or you can just surf the net using a search engine to help you locate information.
What search engine? Online MTV?
I used the World Wide Web to search the archives of the Smithsonian Museum a few weeks ago. I also had to do a homework assignment about the Wright brothers for a history assignment.
Can you show us what you found?
Sure.
Oh, that Smithsonian really does the state of the art, huh?
Oh, wow.
The sad thing is we all remember exactly when the internet looked just like that.
Street View.
Street View. By the way, I do believe you had to set up Windows to do that waving window cursor. That wasn't the default. That's the worst. It was an hourglass, right? You had to turn it into the waving, yeah.
Oh, boy.
Oh, wow.
We just figured it out. Look, I'll show you.
All you have to do is go to playboy.com. Wow. This is great.
Isn't this amazing?
Netscape, the color. Oh, remember the color wizard? I remember that.
Oh, wow.
Oh, all about rainbows. You know, seriously, I worked on shows very much like this. I did a show, a PBS show called The Internet. And it was pretty much this.
Does it exist, Leo? Have you shown
God,
it?
God, I hope not.
Oh, please. Oh,
I hope
please.
It's long gone.
Bounty.
I don't have it. I certainly don't have a copy, but I bet you somebody in the chat room will find it and humiliate me in public. Oh, Lord. I remember Gina Smith did one where she was driving in a convertible down the information superhighway. I don't know if there was singing involved. Look, but
there's Al Gore over there.
Look, there's my imaginary family. All right.
You know, I think we finally found our replacement theme song for This Week in Google.
Hey, maybe, you know what? Let's listen to that. You know what? Can we use that, you think, with impunity?
Do
you think Hometown Productions would mind?
We're riding on the internet, cyberspace set free. Hello, virtual reality.
Cyberspace, it says what we want it to say. Cyberspace sets us free.
Back to appetite, searching for a website, a window to the world, got to get online. Take a spin, now you're in with the techno set. You're going surfing on the internet.
Can we just steal that and...
Well, you find out who owns the rights when you post this on YouTube, won't you?
Perfect. Yeah. Perfect. They'll let us know if there's a problem.
It's a tribute to their wonderful work that we want to do this.
Of course, the YouTube comments are even more fun. I'm not even going to show these. And then they made 4chan. New drinking game. Take a shot every time they say internet. All right. I think it's time for us to get our picks and tools and numbers and all of that stuff. Maybe I can get Matt to throw in a little something. Mr. Matt Katz, we just love you, Matt. You're so sensible. You're so normal. But in a great way.
I appreciate that.
So thank you for being here. I mean, I think in a lot of ways you also reassure. One of the reasons Jeff and I love Google is because we think of Google, it's made of people, like Soylent Green.
Exactly.
We think of you when we think of Google.
Well, and there's so many engineers who feel exactly the same way. Like I was in a meeting yesterday and I said, I'm going to be on a web radio show, and they're like, is it This Week in Google?
Oh, that's
I love
great.
This Week in Google. So there's a ton of people who listen. That's why the feedback that Jeff gives often gets addressed pretty quickly.
Good. No, but really,
I never get invited to what's that neat conference?
Zeitgeist.
Thank you. That's for sales. You're not buying ads.
I never get invited either. I've never been to a single Zeitgeist. So that's
really all right. That makes me feel better.
Yeah.
I need to send that podcast to Nikesh over in sales.
Well, we do send a tip of the hat to all the Googlers who listen. And yes, I always feel I do occasionally go down to Google whenever I'm there. It's always a great feeling because of all the companies that we visit, I really feel that Google is still engineering driven and still doing some really, really exciting stuff. And if Sergey ever wants to have a cookout with his fake meat, we got a barbecue.
I have no idea how good it tastes, but it sounds like, it's intriguing stuff.
I have smoking chips. I have cedar planks. I can make anything taste good.
Yeah. With enough barbecue sauce.
Exactly.
Cheese. It just needs cheese.
Put a little cheese on top, some barbecue sauce, chopped onions. What more do you need? It doesn't matter what it tastes like.
You could have the first kosher cheeseburger, too.
So where does that stand? Do they have that in the cafeteria yet?
Although they're pretty good about vegan and tofu and all that sort of stuff. So there are.
I think they need Brin beef in there.
Brin beef.
Okay. What's for Brinburger. Chipped Brinburger. Brin beef? Brinburger. Brinburger. So what's, anything what's, you'd
what
like to share?
It took 6 months to make that one burger.
It took them 6 months to grow that burger?
To grow it, yeah.
Well, the first one's always the hardest, right?
Yes.
Who knows how much they can speed it up after that?
Applying Kevin, how long does it take to make a cow?
Well, exactly.
This is true.
Good point.
You're being, internet impatient.
That wasn't
beef.
That was veal. No, I, for one, would be glad to give up beef if I could have synthetic bacon that tastes every bit as good as the real thing.
Yeah.
That's all I ask.
By the way, Matt, what's your 1 month challenge this month?
I am doing at least 30 minutes of exercise a day. So
good, you can do those M100s, the burpees and then the jumps and the
more
running,
just
man.
Running and biking.
30 minutes of exercise a day is a great one. That's a good one to do. And let me know if that becomes a habit, because I've done that and it never became a habit ever.
it might not stick, but at least I'll get 30 days of exercise.
I did for the last year. I did an hour a day. Every day of Pilates, every day. And the minute I could stop, I did.
Yeah.
Well, the best one for me was when I was actually commuting on my bike to Google every day.
That's the way to do it.
I was doing a huge amount of cycling a week.
Yeah.
It's nice. What was the distance for that, Kevin?
I'm not sure exactly, but because it was in two phases.
Don't tell me kilometers.
Here to the station and then the other station there. But it was about, it was about 90 minutes of cycling a day.
Oh, wow. That's a lot. That's good. That's good. So any tip you want to share with us? Anything?
Yeah, actually, I do have a tip. It's a post that we just did in the last week to the Google's Webmaster blog, and it's actually a feature we've been wanting to launch for a long time. So if you think about how the ideal search engine would work, you would ask yourself, well, why is my website ranking or not ranking? And one of the big questions that people have, since I'm head of the web spam team, they ask me, well, has the web spam team taken any action on my website? So we've now rolled out a new feature in google.com/webmasters. It's a feature called Webmaster Tools. It's totally free. And basically, you just go to it, and once you've proven that you own a site,
you can click and you can see whether the web spam team has taken any manual action on your site. So, for example, if you're hacked, cloaking, hidden text, all sorts of different stuff. We've got like 10 or 11 categories. We've got brand new documentation and web pages to explain if you do have problems. And we actually give you example URLs or sections of your site that we think might be infected or hacked or have problems with spam. So it's a lot more transparent than we've ever been in the past. And I'm really excited that we're able to do this now.
That's cool.
Really neat. Cool. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a big, big launch for us.
Yeah. Really cool. I'm going to play with it. See if you've ever touched me.
Yeah. I should have checked twit.tv before I came online.
There's good touch and there's bad touch, Matt. I just want you to know the difference. That's all I'm saying. The NSA has touched 1.6% of us.
That's going to hit my numbers in a minute.
Well, let's get a number from Mr. Jeffrey Jarvis.
Well, a series of numbers. Since we didn't do it earlier, I'll do it now. So I wrote a little piece for the blog in The Guardian looking at when the NSA said they touched only 1.6% of daily internet traffic. What does that mean? Well, they say that the net carries 1,826 petabytes of information per day, and that the NSA touches 29 petabytes a day, if that proportion is right, right? So what touch means, we don't know. It could be an ingest, store, analyze, we don't know. All right, so 29 petabytes a day, 1.6%. Google in 2010, before they shut up about this, said that they indexed 0.004% of data on the net. That would make the NSA 400 Googles. 7 petabytes of photos are added to Facebook each month. That's 0.23 petabytes per day. That would mean that the NSA is 126 Facebooks.
Wow.
Now, mind you, most of the data passing through the net is not email or web pages. It's media. Sandvine data says that the U.S. fixed net, of course, that's only a portion of it, in 2013, real-time entertainment accounted for 62% of net traffic, P2P file sharing for 10.5%. Now, HTTP, the web, accounts for only 11.8% of aggregated up and down, even though maybe you only have to look at half of that, right? Here's the punchline. Communications, the part of the net that the NSA really cares about, accounts for 2.9% in the U.S. So by very rough, beer-soaked napkin calculation, the NSA's 1.6% of net traffic would be about half of all the communication on the net, which is a hell of a lot of touching, good and bad. And by the way, let's keep in mind that about 3/4 of email is spam. So when the NSA says it touches only 1.6% of traffic on the net, don't be too assured.
That's because there's so much that is the dark net that nobody sees or can touch, including Google.
Right. Jeff, I think even just the very high level point you made that a large fraction of the web is Netflix or YouTube, and that's not as interesting, and that's 30, 40, 50, whatever percent of the web it is, that changes the baseline of what you should look at.
Immensely.
And I think that's it's a really important point. I got to make that point to someone else earlier today. So thank you for that blog post that you did.
Wow. Numbers.
So a few numbers.
Not lies.
Week, but numbers.
Damn lies and NSA statistics. Kevin Marks, you have anything you'd like, a tip, a tool, a number, anything you'd like to pass along?
It's sort of slightly oblique, but it's Wired did an article this week about Indie Web Camp, which is an event that I've been involved with, which is trying to rebuild the independent web, trying to get back to the idea of hosting our own sites and connecting to each other and that. So it's just as Anil wrote the thing of like we need to go back to the web we used to have. It's that kind of thinking, but not saying everyone should have their own website and that's the only thing they should be, but working out how you can do that and coexist with the large institutions and things. And one project from that is something called IndieAuth, which is interesting project that's written by Aaron Parecki. And the idea is, if you want to do authorization and logging in, that's actually quite annoying and a painful thing to implement yourself, and you have to deal with a lot of security and things like that. And so the way it works is you log in with your own site, it looks for links on your site to big auth providers and uses them to log in and verify that the connection works both ways. So you can log in with your own site using Twitter, using Google, using GitHub, using many different auth providers. But what the login is keeping is your own site. So this is an interesting twist on authentication and way to think about that, because what it's saying is instead of you're relying on the giant provider like Facebook, Google, or Twitter, you're still keeping your own identity with this. And you can rely on any one of these independently. So if one of them, you know, shuts you down, you don't lose everything. So there's a lot of interesting thinking going on in this group. There was a workshop last week with W3C where several of the IndieWeb people presented, and that was I learned a lot of that, and it was a very interesting thing to go to. So IndieAuth, if you're thinking about developers and authorization, it's an interesting different perspective.
Very cool. I guess my tip is, and we talked about what you can do about the NSA and privacy, and you should write your members of Congress and join EFF and give them money, and I do all that. But you know what else you should do? You should learn to code, and everybody should learn to code, and you should get your kids to learn to code, because ultimately the people who are going to be doing the freedom fighting are the people who are going to be able to write code, and that should be you. And it's never too late. And there's so many ways to do it on the web. The web is loaded with great resources. We know we've talked about many of them before. CodeAcademy.com is a great one. It makes it very simple. Online courses. I've mentioned how to design programs, which is the old MIT Press and Duke University text for an introduction to programming. It will teach you the best way to code. And, of course, for kids, Randy Pausch's Alice Project, which is still going on, even though we've lost Randy at Carnegie Mellon, is a great way for kids who love video games to learn how to program and they don't even know it. If you've got a proven way to teach and retain CS majors, it says Alice.org is a great one to download. Get your kids programming. You can learn to code too. Not only is it a fun hobby, but I think in the long run, it's our last best hope. Thanks for joining us. I love Kevin Marks. I love Matt Cutts. I love you, too, Mr. Jeff Jarvis. Gina will be back next week. We do this show. We love you for being here every Wednesday, 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern time. That's 2000 UTC on twit.tv. You can watch live, but if you can't get it live, we've got on-demand audio and video always available at our website, twit.tv/twig, and you can subscribe and get every single episode week by week as they come out on all the better podcast subscription utilities, Downcast, Instacast, Pocket Cast, iTunes, and the rest. So please subscribe. That way you'll get them all. You'll hear our new theme music next week. I'm really serious. We should use that. Let's do it. At least until they cease and desist. I'm Lee Holdaport. Stay tuned. Esther Dyson on the triangulation coming up next. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time on This Week in Google. Take a spin, now you're in with the techno set. You're going surfing on the internet.
Say, what have you done
to my show?